Good evening. Life simply isn't fair, as anybody who's so much switched on the news or opened a newspaper this week would tell you. On the other side of the Atlantic, the President, a man whose serial and opportunistic immorality has been made public in excruciating detail, is still in the Oval Office. The midterm elections that were supposed to be an opportunity for America to register its disgust at his behaviour proved nothing of the sort. The public didn't seem to mind. The groper is still in the White House, the threat of impeachment apparently gone. Here, poor Ron Davies is being publicly crucified. Whatever the indecency was on the Monday, he did the decent thing on the Tuesday and resigned from his job as Welsh Secretary, hoping that would draw a line under the whole business as far as the public interest was concerned. Fat chance. As anybody could have told him, and probably did, making a mystery of it merely ensured that an agonising couple of days became a long, drawn-out torture by degrees, by leak and speculation and the long, slow trawl through his past. No matter that you could say he brought it on himself, God knows what the man and his family are going through. The wider question, of course, is how much we have the right to know about the private lives and sexual conduct of public figures. To what extent should they be held accountable for how they act outside their public roles? The new and rather more difficult question is whether that accountability ceases when he or she leaves public office. I'm Oral Mays with our regular panel, Janet Daly of The Telegraph, the medical ethicist from Oxford, Dr. David Cook, Dr. David Starkey, the constitutional historian, and Professor Ian Hargreaves. Ian.
Well, I'm not sure the Ron Davies affair tells us very much about the morality of privacy. It appears to be a story about the failure to come clean, which is properly a capital offence in politics. Not that we should believe everything we read in the tabloids, much of it from handsomely bribed anonymous witnesses. But who can doubt that we live in an age of lost privacy? When one man and a computer terminal is a global publishing system, the idea that we can restrain scurrilous gossip is the fancy of a bygone age. People in public life, I'm afraid, have got no choice but to adapt.
Janet Daly?
Well, ideally, it would be nice if newspapers didn't trawl gratuitously over people's lives looking for ugly secrets to expose. But what would it mean to frame a rule that stated explicitly what was a legitimate matter of public concern and which aspects of a politician's life were or were not relevant to his public duties? Who has the right to decide which kinds of conduct are discussable? How can we decide what character traits are relevant to political power? We've seen how sinister and offensive it seems when the BBC lays down a prohibition on any mention of one cabinet minister's private life. How much more disturbing would it be to see a wide-ranging regulation that banned whole areas of comment and reporting?
David Starkey.
In theory, I would very much like there to be a strict division between public and private. I frequently argued on this programme that I simply don't believe that a man who cheats on his wife or indeed who cheats on his boyfriend necessarily cheats on the public. But there is a problem. We do not live in a world in which politics is simply about ideas. We've moved forward from the 19th century and we've moved forward into a politics which is based almost entirely on personality, on image, on the deployment of family, on the feel-good factor. And it's also based on the fact that most politicians, to say nothing of most celebrities in public life, have entered into a Faustian compact with the media. In such circumstances, it is utterly artificial to try to make a division between public and private.
David Cook.
Well, people are amazing because on the one side, we all love gossip. We have a kind of insatiable appetite for intimate details of public figures. We become a kind of operatic nation of peeping toms, voyeuristic, who have a prurient interest in public confession, revenge and kiss-and-tell memoirs. But we've also got a need for privacy, occasions where we can be ourselves, where we can have intimacy. We need, in those situations, to trust people, to have confidence, to be sure of their discretion. But leaders are just like us, fallible, gullible, all too human, not saints, but struggling sinners. The problem is when politicians pretend, when they're hypocritical, when they lie, or just plain economical with the truth.
Panel, thanks very much indeed. Our first witness is the Right Reverend Jim Thompson, the Bishop of Bath and Wells, of course. Bishop, it's difficult not to feel sorry for Ron Davies, but at the end of the day, this seems to be somebody who's been involved in a morally discreditable action, and he's a senior government minister. Isn't it right, indeed proper, for the truth to come out?
I think the way in which people are pursued down to the last detail of their personal lives and their family lives is a very serious sign of the nature of our society, because we must be one of a seriously immoral society in many ways. And it's almost as though the guilt we carry because we are so full of this immorality, has to find its own scapegoats, and people have to be pursued. I think the spoilt way in which journalists and others say we have to have the whole truth, irrespective of what it might be doing to people, is something that is degrading to observe.
David Cook, your witness.
Well, two things. The interesting thing about this week's events is that it wasn't the press pursuing an individual. It was an individual who, because of something that he did, chose to make a resignation, and on that basis the press then said, why? Is that improper?
Well, I think the question is whether there is a way out for a person by resignation. If the responsibility for what he's done affects his public role, his public responsibilities, then presumably that is something which the public would have a right to an interest
in. But we don't know whether it will or will not, because we're not quite sure what happened.
Well, I realise that, and it would be very difficult to draw any line. I quite see that. But the truth is not just something that he did or did not do at a particular time. The truth is also about the relationships he has with other people. Truth is not just an abstract thing or an event.
But isn't part of that relationship a relationship with his constituents, with the country that he represents, with the Welsh nation which he stood for?
Yes, absolutely. And the resignation, the admission, the penitence, and saying he'd made a complete mess of it, seemed to me to be the thing that he had to do. But that they should pursue him into the very place of his own home and his own family and his own relationship seems to me to have an immorality about it, which is worse than the offence in the first place.
So where did this come from, then? Why have we become such an immoral nation, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think it is a sort of projection, and people carry within themselves a considerable amount of guilt for their own broken relationships, their own betrayals, their own sexual behaviour.
But aren't they also looking for leadership? Aren't they looking for honesty? Aren't they looking for values? And don't they look to leaders, whether in politics or the church, who will actually embody those values?
Yes, I think they do look for that they do look for that sort of leadership. But it's no good expecting these leaders, on whom a great deal is projected, no good expecting them to be sort of totally inhuman and not subject to failure, subject to weakness. That's something that's very real about them all. The question is, is it right to pursue them right to the end of the line? And I think, Michael, you used the word crucify in your introduction. And I feel that is what has been happening.
Janet, your witness.
You said that it was immoral and cruel to pursue the whole truth. But who is to decide which bits of the truth are enough? How do we know, except in long retrospect, how much of the truth we needed to know?
Yes, I do give that point. I think that it is difficult to say. I think the moral decision there lies with the people who do the gossip, give the interviews. The people, they have to make their own decisions. We live in a wicked world.
You mean the journalists themselves?
The journalists themselves.
So you're giving the journalists this enormous moral responsibility of deciding how much truth the public has a right to know.
Well, I think that they could consider it, instead of the feeling that I have, and this is only a feeling, that they are interested in the story, they are interested in selling the story. Mm. I don't see much moral judgment going on at all.
But you...
they can't be free of moral responsibility for their own
But you're, you seem to be wanting to give them much more moral responsibility. You seem to be wanting to say the editor of The Sun should decide how much we are all going to know about our political leaders. He should make a moral judgment that we've learnt enough.
Well, I think he has himself, if it's a he has himself moral responsibility for his own behaviour. He is not free. He does not have the absolute right to a person's truth.
But he does have a right to decide how much we should know. That's what you're suggesting.
I don't see how we can avoid that without having repressive legislation. But that means that the moral responsibility does partly lie with him.
Ian Hargreaves?
Bishop, I agree with you that journalists have to take moral responsibility for what they decide to report and publish. But let's just put a different moral angle on an aspect of this story, by no means the least controversial bit of it. Ron Davies' first wife decides that she will give an interview to the Mail on Sunday in which she describes a rather loveless, sexless marriage. Is that an immoral act on her behalf? Is it a moral or immoral act of the journalist and the newspaper to agree to carry it? Does she not have, in some sense, a right to be heard?
Well, we live in a world which is wicked, and very often, and one sees wicked things happen. And I would say that she has made an immoral decision because she has brought into the open things that were not appropriate at that time. But she has the perfect, she has the right to do it. I'm not trying to stop people having the right. I'm just trying to talk about the morality of the thing. If it was me, in my conscience, what would I think was right?
But you are then making a judgment about the extent to which she feels hurt in the way that she was treated, and suggesting that she should censor herself in some wider public moral interest. Why should she see it in those terms? I mean, you are wanting to impose upon her something which is not in her own interest.
No, I'm not trying to impose upon her. I'm saying that in her moral, her own moral decision, she has to think about the way in which what she says will make, what impact it will make.
David Starkey.
Bishop, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that Mr. Davis's resignation meant that he's now entitled to a privacy. Correct?
A degree of privacy.
A degree.
Yes.
And the degree is precisely what we're trying to...
Indeed. That's what I'm trying to discuss with you.
Yes, well, let's try and do so. In his resignation statement, he produced extraordinarily private revelations about the fact that he was beaten by his father. He did what all politicians do in those circumstances, invoked his relationship, his private relationship with his wife and his daughter, which other people hadn't done. So wasn't he actually parading a particular version of his private life in front of us to arouse our sympathy? Wasn't it crude and manipulative? And don't we have a right to scrutinise that?
No, because...
Why not?
Because the situation was created by all the speculation in the papers the days before.
The situation, Bishop, forgive me, was created by his act, wasn't
it? Yes, wasn't it created by his act?
Apparently three acts.
The situation was created by what he did. It was also created by who he was, by what his experience was, by what his relationships had been. The truth, if one wants the truth, goes a lot deeper than just what happened in on Clapham Common at a particular moment. The truth goes back into his whole life story. Now, why did he
tell... Is this an argument for less privacy or for more?
Well, I think it's a question of who has the right to share his own particular story. So that's the question.
So you're saying, as you've now said it, it's a question of who has the right to share that privacy. He then has the right, does he, according to you, simply to give us an edited, possibly doctored version of his private life to arouse our sympathy.
In the face of being cornered as he was, I am not at all surprised, as a human being, not just as a politician, having said I'm sorry and having cut off...
Having lied when he said he was sorry. But the bishop hasn't replied. If you accept that he lied, just speculatively, do you still think that he's entitled to have his privacy protected?
I think it's very easy for people in the outside situation to judge the person who...
Not judging. Well, I'm asking a very simple question.
Well, you said it three times in a very aggressive way, and
somebody
to me
else
that came across as...
Somebody else asked
Yes, David, be quiet. David Cook.
Can I just ask you, Bishop, how you want this editing? You've talked about the Sun editor, you've talked about the first wife and her need to be self-editing. Where is the moral impetus going to come from that's going to enable people not to be so immoral, not to be so selfish?
Well, I think the moral impetus comes from the person themselves, and he has to work out his own responsibility for his own actions.
Do-it-yourself morality.
No, not at all. He is an individual. I mean, if we're going to talk about that, then we have to ask, why is our society so homophobic? And what happens to people who are pushed into corners of deception because they are not able to admit, without abandoning their own position, to having gay
parts of their body. But Chris Smith was quite happy to admit.
Yes, but I mean, it's okay for Chris Smith. Was it all right for Ron?
Davis. Janet Daly, last question.
I still don't understand your position about privacy. Does he have a right to make use of the facts of his private life and his childhood and his background to encourage us to be sympathetic with him, but no one else has a right to make any comment or to elicit facts about his private life in order perhaps to incriminate him or to discover that he is not telling the truth?
No, I don't think... I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that he... In the first instance, I think when he resigned and when he apologised and when he made those apologies, that was a perfectly feasible place for the thing to stop. But once he has opened up his own story in that way, then I think that is undoubtedly gives other people rights as well in the situation.
Bishop, thank you very much indeed. Our next witness is Michael Brown, who's the former MP for Brigham Cleethorpes. In fact, he was an MP from 1979 until 1997 and an undeclared homosexual up until about 1994, wasn't it? You were a junior government whip at that particular time when the News of the World printed a story about him going on holiday with a young man then aged just under 21, and that was when the minimum age of consent, of course, was 21. You resigned the night before it was published, on the Saturday night, as I understand it. Was the newspaper right to pursue that story and to print it?
Yes, I think in retrospect it was. I mean, I was a lawmaker and I had broken the law. And the fact that the law was being changed at that minute and just 8 weeks later was given the royal assent, unfortunately, makes no difference. I was in a situation where I had broken the law and I was a party to making the law. So that was the reason why I had no hesitation in arriving within seconds of being told that this story was about to break, that I had to resign.
That must give you a sort of community of interest and a sympathy for what Ron Davis is going through at the moment. Do you think it was more or less legitimate for the press to pursue Ron Davis?
I'm afraid that he has not handled the manner of his resignation the way that I would advise. I mean, I have some experience.
We're not talking about handling, and we're talking about the morality of it.
Well, I'm in that case, yes, I'm afraid it was inevitable. Whether it was right, the blunt truth is, it was going in a free society, it's going to happen.
Janet Daly.
Your story isn't really like Ron Davis's at all, is it? I mean,
there are only minor parallels.
Yes, I mean, sort of generously said that you feel it was right, that your story, given that you'd broken the law and so on, that you did bear that responsibility. But in fact, you were actually conducting a private life. You went on a private holiday. What Ron Davis did, he didn't do in a private place. He did in a public place, in a sense. Can there be any argument, any feasible argument, to say it's my private life when you're carrying it out in Clapham Common?
Not when you're a cabinet minister, no. If you are going to resolve this issue, I think you need to look at it through the other end of the telescope and recognise that the conclusion from all of this is that we should stop criminalising people for the offence which is commonly known as cottaging. I think that's the way round.
Sorry to interrupt you, Janet. Wouldn't it be that, I mean, to an extent, this homosexual putative homosexual aspects that may or may not have been concerned with this are irrelevant?
Yeah, they are irrelevant.
He's a married man.
If you are a cabinet, the higher up the ladder of ministerial office you go, in my case I was a junior minister, if you're a cabinet minister, a higher standard of public morality, whether we like it or not, appears to apply. I may not like that, he may not like that, but it appears to be the case.
I think perhaps it's not even a question of morality, of making judgments about people's moral behaviour. Perhaps it is, as he put it in the first instance, a question of judgment. I mean, you're implying, perhaps implicitly, that you're stuck with it. As politicians, you have to maintain this high standard of moral behaviour because for some reason, bizarre reason, you have to be role models for the rest of society. But let me put it to you that even if we take that angle out of it, even if we take moral behaviour out of it, it's a question of judgment.
It's unwise judgment. As one who was a whip who used to advise people who got themselves in a mess, I would always say, look here, if you are a cabinet minister, you are putting yourself in a dodgy situation from your own career point of view.
Oh, yes, forgive me, you're putting it rather crassly. I didn't mean just from his point of view of his career. I mean, do we want somebody to have political power, power over the lives of other people, if they make that dubious a judgment about how they should be behaving, who they should be consorting with, where they should be doing it?
I'm not quite sure about that. I mean, this is the if he lies to his wife, he's incapable of being
No, it's not a question of whether he lies to his wife. If you wander out onto Clapham Common into an area that is known to be a homosexual haunt, and you allow yourself to be picked up by strangers, and you end up in a place that is known to be a drug trafficking haunt, isn't that a reflection on judgment that we're not very happy with in people who have political power?
It's certainly, to put it mildly, unwise and foolish, and it, if discovered, is going to lead to your resignation.
Can I ask you, you said this is the question, if he lies to his wife, can we trust him not to lie to us? And Janet dismissed it, but would you like to address it?
I will, and I think that side of this argument is a lot of tosh. There have been plenty of examples down the course of political history. For goodness sake, David Lloyd George and David Starkey here, I'm quite sure will be able to offer many examples of outstanding politicians. Alan Clark. Thank God for people like Alan Clark in the House of Commons at a time when we've got robot MPs and colourless and characterless MPs. I do take very strongly the view that it is absolutely vital to have flawed characters in the House of Commons, because flawed characters are invariably great members of Parliament, great ministers.
Ian Hargreaves.
Going back to your own case, after you had resigned but continued to be a Member of Parliament, you say attention was distracted because John Smith sadly died a few days afterwards. But
that was only nationally. The attention was not distracted locally, I can assure you. So I still had local issues to address.
Do you feel that it was proper, or would have been proper, for the press to continue to find out more things about your private life and publish them on the grounds that you were still an MP and your moral character was of interest to your constituents?
Yes, it was. I didn't like it, but I am enough of a realist, having been in politics now for over 20 years, although I'm not there now. When I was there, I was there for nearly 20 years. And I think it was inevitable and understandable that the local newspaper and the letters to the editor's column from my constituents wanted to address the issue. I mean, I have to say that I fumbled my way to coming out, in inverted commas, only thanks to the News of the World. I will regret to my dying day the fact that I did not have the courage to do that until the News of the World came along. But I will say this, my constituents were aware of what, for me, was not a secret. It was an open secret. Nobody fell off their chairs needing smelling salts in my constituency when they found out.
I'm glad to hear it. We wouldn't want deaths to be reported as a result of the incident. But doesn't it follow from what you've just said that Ron Davies remains a member of Parliament for Caerphilly?
He still has a relationship with his constituents to address.
And therefore the public examination of his moral character is an entirely proper matter for the press and for the media.
It is, with this difference, the people of his constituency have the opportunity of ousting him directly, if that is what they would do. I don't think they're going to do that, actually. I think it's quite clear that he has a reasonably good relationship with his constituents. But that is the difference between being a minister and resigning, where your appointment is made not by the people, but by the Prime Minister. In this case, his appointment can be taken away directly through the democratic ballot box process.
David Cook.
Mr. Brown, I'm intrigued about two moral principles that you've enunciated to us. The first is, it was all right to break the law. What was not all right was to be caught. In your case, you were quite happy to go and break.
No, I wasn't happy. I knew one day that something awful.
You wouldn't have resigned until the News of the World blew the whistle.
No, that's right. I was as human as everybody else.
So it's getting caught, which is the problem.
Well, hang on. I think you're being a little bit hard. I had made it quite clear through speeches in Parliament that I resented the age of consent being 21. It was quite clear that I had, on a number of occasions in the past, on the issue of homosexuality, broken the law, along with people in the army who paid similar prices with their jobs. I don't defend myself.
But it brings me nicely to the other moral principle you're enunciating, which is, if someone in government breaks the law, what we should do is change the law and decriminalise it, and that way it'll be all right.
No, that's a slight travesty of what I was suggesting.
We're talking about victimless crime, weren't you?
The blunt truth is, we all break the law. Where are you going to extend that principle?
Well, members
of Parliament get done for speeding. Members of Parliament get done for drink driving. Ministers occasionally may get done for that. Are you suggesting in that situation that they should resign as members of Parliament or government ministers?
David Starkey, last quick question.
Are you actually, Michael, because this is what you seem to be saying, that potentially there is no limit at all to what we should know about the private lives of public figures?
While I would like it to be otherwise, I think my experience, both on the one hand as a politician and now as a journalist, tells me that it is inevitable in this media age where, as you said earlier in the programme, David, we concentrate so much on personalities. We've brought it on ourselves.
Michael Brown, thanks very much indeed. Our last witness is Perry Six, who's the Deputy Director of Policy and Research at Demos, the think tank, and author of The Future of Privacy, squarely where we are this evening. Perry, if you're a publicly elected political leader in your country, any character flaw is of justifiable interest to that electorate, isn't it?
Well, we have to distinguish between what the law should require and what morality should state. It seems to me a perfectly reasonable moral position to say that not every character flaw is obviously relevant to your competence to lead, and therefore, in straight morality, we would say that unless someone could show that your deceitfulness in your private life in some concrete way could be shown, at least there was a reasonable suspicion of it spilling over into your public life, then in fundamental morality we would say that that would be protected by privacy. However, as a matter of public policy, I think it was Ian who used the phrase a Faustian compact, politicians are... I'm sorry, David Starkey. Politicians...
Long words tend to be marked.
It's a very dangerous error.
Both of them.
I do think that politicians have entered a nature of agreement about how they come into public life, which other people, with the exception of a few celebrities in the sporting field and so on, have not. There are other people who enter public life involuntarily, or who enter professions or become successful without ever expecting to enter into public life, for whom I think things are very different. But politicians, I think, have genuinely surrendered something here.
David Starkey?
So, in other words, you actually agree with what Michael Brown said, that with this kind of politics of personality and displaying of being a nice chap with a nice wife and nice kids, potentially there is no limit.
There certainly are limits. I mean, for example, I don't think Ron Davis had any particular claim to privacy, but that doesn't mean that the press acted fairly or properly. For example, the press seemed to have published material from his statements to the police. Now, there are real issues about whether or not that violation of his so-called privacy has prejudiced a fair trial. Privacy is not just a matter of what is revealed. It is also about how it is collected. Even if you climb up on a ladder outside my window at night, but you do not discover anything new that you did not know about my appalling sexual behaviour, you have still violated my privacy by the manner in which you have gone about it. And I think there is a reasonable suspicion that some of the press have violated some reasonable rules here. It seems to me the question is, what is the journalistic purpose, and is it necessary to go to those lengths? And I'm not sure that in all the cases of the last 10 days it has been.
But if we actually look at Mr. Davis, the essential problem has been a very simple one, hasn't it? He did not apparently tell the whole truth. However loosely one describes that. We have heard leaks from the Prime Minister's office. They didn't understand it. In those circumstances, isn't it A, inevitable, and B, isn't it proper for the press to scrutinise, ask questions, use yes. all sorts of methods?
Yes, it is. In general, I believe that there is a special duty of scrutiny upon the press. But that does not mean that that duty will allow one to do absolutely anything. Clearly, it does not allow you to violate the laws of trespass, of harassment, of nuisance, or of theft in the course of gathering information.
But can we go to another point, which I put to a previous witness, namely the Bishop, our first witness? I pointed out that in his House of Commons resignation statement, Ron Davis repeatedly violated his own privacy, rather as the Prince and Princess of Wales did, memorably. He called attention to the fact that he'd been an abused child. He paraded his feelings and the feelings of his wife and daughter. In those circumstances, how can you have this selective right to privacy?
Well, let's distinguish between a right and a duty. The right of privacy is a rebuttable one. It surely concerns those areas over which you may refuse other people's consent to collect and disclose information about you. When you disclose information in the kind of full confessional glory of a Ron Davis speech or a Clinton apology, then clearly you are consenting to other people disclosing that information.
There is a difference between the two of them. Ron Davis resigned and President Clinton didn't. The question posed at the beginning of this programme was, should that resignation draw some sort of line, give him some additional privacy that he need not necessarily have had a right to if he had not resigned?
Well, it clearly does not give him additional privacy over the period for which he was Secretary of State for Wales. If during that period his conduct, his professional conduct, was in any way swayed by the threats of blackmail or any other aspect of his personal life, then clearly the fact that he has now resigned does not prohibit the press from scrutiny over that. I think it is reasonable to say that the responsibilities, the professional responsibilities of a backbencher, being somewhat less than those of a minister, it would now, I think, for any new offences that we might suggest had some relationship to his professional abilities, there would be a higher threshold of reasonable suspicion before the duty of scrutiny on the press would kick in.
Ian Hargreaves.
One of the arguments that you've made in your book is that you see a case to defend some standard of privacy for there to be a body, a power, which will stop newspapers disclosing private things about other people, that there will be prior restraint of the press. How can that possibly work in a time of media technology where anybody can bang their material up on the internet and we can all watch it all over the world?
Well, it can only work as well as any form of injunctive relief can work. I mean, if you take the view that our whole legal system of injunctions is no longer viable because of the speed of modern technology, that's a separate argument. But clearly, people do know when they have lost some privacy there, and it does normally take time for people to write things up for newspapers to go to press. There is a fundamental difference, which English law has always recognised, between privacy and breach of confidence, if you like, in the legal term, on the one hand, and slander and libel on the other. If I tell a falsehood about you, then if you take me to court and the court finds that I have indeed libeled you, then that finding, plus the damages that I will have to pay you, sufficiently compensate for the damage, or should do. On the other hand, the revealing of something which is true about you, a breach of privacy, cannot be compensated for by damages. Only an injunction can do that. Now, I don't think a politician is entitled to go for that. I restrict this to non-politicians.
All right, Janet Daly.
You imply that there are absolutely indisputable criteria for determining what is true and not true. Isn't the whole point of tabloid exploration, even investigative journalism, the fact that we don't always know until sometimes long after the fact what was not only true but what was relevant? It isn't that easy to decide, even when somebody has resigned his office, what is going to turn out to be relevant, except perhaps in the view of history. And that's why investigative journalism has to be no holds barred.
Well, it doesn't have to be no holds barred. I mean, certainly it is true that we don't always know the full truth until we've had a huge great argument and people have gone and found out. The question is, when is it proper to conduct that investigation in the first place? Now, in other organisations that have a duty of scrutiny, we have a test of a reasonable suspicion. So for the police, for example, there is a test of a reasonable suspicion before the police can proceed. It seems to me not unreasonable to say that the same should apply to journalists.
Forgive me, that's because the police have peculiar powers. You know, I mean, the police, unless we were in a police state, the police have to be
exactly
checked by grounds of reasonable suspicion. A tabloid editor, whatever power he has, can't actually slap you in prison or even drag you before a court. This is just freedom of discussion.
A tabloid editor can collect and disclose information without your consent, can certainly damage your reputation, can reveal truths about you which may be irrelevant or misleading, can damage your career. Now, all of those things, it seems to me, are serious sanctions. They have the right to do that, duty, but that duty must be set about with some proper restrictions, such as a threshold test.
Can we explore these restrictions? Let's imagine a hypothetical situation where a journalist says something about a public figure, and then the institution in which the journalist said this says you're not allowed to talk about this anymore. Are these proper drawing lines?
I imagine you have a particular case in mind from last week.
The answer very simply is yes.
Yes. It's very subtle, isn't it? Yes.
Would you, a very brief answer? I may not, of course, mention the particular case.
A very brief answer.
It seems to me that arbitrary rules relating to particular individuals are usually bad rules. The This is a case in which the individual, whenever that person has been asked about their sexual behaviour, has never actually denied it, has just said, well, Burn Lodge, it's none of your business, but if you really press me, oh, well, all right, you know, I'll say something about it. That seems to me a fundamentally different case, where someone has not refused consent to the disclosure of information. And to make arbitrary rules about single individuals seems to me absolutely the wrong way to go about
this. I think we've covered that issue in fair detail. Barry Six, thanks very much indeed.
Howard reigns, okay.
Not at all. A dignified restraint. Before we pick the witnesses to pieces...
At least let him get out of the room.
No. Ian Hargreaves, you were saying earlier that there were striking differences between the way the Welsh press had covered this and the way the national, London-based press...
Yes. When Ron Davies withdrew to Wales after his resignation from the cabinet, he obviously wanted to be judged in Wales and still thinks that he has a political career there. And if you look at the Welsh papers in the last week, what you see is a great deal of restraint and suspicion about what is being reported in the London tabloids. They'd heard these rumours for years, they say, and chosen not to publish them. So there is a very, very different tone. And there is out there in the non-London press still a belief that you shouldn't pay people to give you information, that if you pay someone to give a story, there's a chance they'll make it up.
There's also a thing called cronyism, isn't there, which is particularly rampant in Taffy land.
Thank you, David, for that. Can I ask you a slightly less controversial and stop your racist spleen emerging? What did you make... Oh, dear, why am I asking this question? What did you make of the Bishop's point that, to some extent, what's happening to Ron Davies is a projection on him of our own moral inadequacies?
I'm sure that's true. We all rejoice, alas, in each other's problems. But I was astonished... Well, I was astonished at a whole series of things. It seemed to me to be one of the most disconnected and illogical pieces of evidence that have ever come before the moral maze. But two things shocked me, both what he said and what he didn't say. His apparent indifference to things like lying, his apparent notion that we are judges, even in a highly manipulative situation, about what we put into the public domain. But above all, I thought once upon a time, and you, David, are much more expert in this than I am, there was a duty of prophetic utterance to criticise the doings of the powerful. And that this included, if the Old Testament is any guide, and King Ahab or whatever of the rest of them are any guide, it didn't only include being nasty to the poor, it also included personal moral behaviour. Now, I, as a secular humanist, am indifferent to that. He, as a Christian bishop, I thought might just have noticed it.
David Cook, I feel you ought to be...
Yes, well, it would certainly be nice to have...
There was an element of kindness about the bishop's approach to this.
There was an element of kindness. I think it was sad not to have that element of judgment, which is very strong and standing for standards. I think the difficulty I found was the mixture of optimism and of realism. On the one side, he was highly optimistic that this editor of The Sun and that wives would not blow whistles and we could appeal to their self-good and they would make up their own morality. On the other side, he told us that we're all immoral. Yes, we are, but I was looking for a cure. I was looking for that prophetic voice, which didn't knock people down, but give us some chance to build up.
I thought Michael Brown was rather touching with his "It was a fair cop."
Yes.
But he also wasn't terribly clear on the central question here, which is, does saying, I'm sorry, I don't really want to go into details, I made a complete hash of all this, I've done something terribly wrong, I'm not fit to be a government minister, I resign, this business of, should that actually be enough to pull the shutters
down? No, it can't be, because we still don't know what you did. And we have to know, because...
Why do we have to know?
Because it might have impinged, it might have impacted on your governmental duties. I mean, for example, suppose the scandal had involved cronyism, corruption, favouritism, whatever, nepotism. You can't just say, well, I made a big mistake and I resigned, but I'm not going to tell you what I did, what it was about, who else was involved, what the ramifications were. That's not good enough.
And in any case, Michael, aren't you confusing resignation with some kind of sacramental act? Resignation.
Yes.
Is not absolution.
No.
It doesn't sponge and wash things clean. And above all, as in fact as our last witness...
Wonderful religious language.
I've read the Bible too, David. And as Perry Six also said, there's something else. At the moment he committed that act, he was still a minister, still scrutinises.
Good point, Ian Hargreaves.
And he remains a public figure, I mean, literally, definitely, in the sense that he's an MP. But even if you were not an MP, he's a public figure. In one of the questions that I think that journalists might sometimes reflect on in this kind of debate is whether they themselves as public figures, whether the editors of newspapers ought to be open to this kind of scrutiny, to which the answer is surely yes.
They get very touchy when it happens.
It has happened.
Thank you, David. Janet Daly.
You have to realise that by trying to assert some sort of rule or regulation, even if you don't have a law of privacy, even if you just have an ethical code, you're giving journalists and editors more moral responsibility. You're making them the arbiters of public and social morality in a way that seems to me to be quite inexcusable. If you let them do their thing, providing that they're not telling lies about people for which they would be legally culpable, then at least you're not giving them a kind of Solomon's role of deciding what we should know, what should be exposed, what shouldn't be exposed. Can you imagine the scope for bribery, for favoritism, for cronyism, for corruption? If your friend, your politician friends, were not exposed because you decided that then it wasn't morally acceptable to expose
them. It certainly used
them.
To be the case, did it not, David Starkey?
Well, yes.
It did, but it was a different type of politics. We're now in a politics of celebrity and personality in which I fear and I hate the thought and I disapprove of it, but there it is. There are no limits.
David Cook.
But it's interesting that that cult of personality, which we've seen writ large in the States, where everybody knows every single intimate detail about President Clinton's behaviour, still the public vote in favour. But in order to vote one way or the other, they need to know the truth.
But Ian Hargreaves, very briefly, that's a rather special case in the States. I mean, the knowledge of what actually happens in politicians' private life is rather more scant in the United States than here, but you have very little time
to agree or disagree. I have a feeling that Michael Brown is right, that Ron Davies is not finished in Wales, that the public
the
public will find it possible to go on with him.
Panel, thanks very much indeed. That's it for this week. From our panel, Janet Daly, David Cook, David Starkey and Ian Hargreaves, and from me, until the same time next week, goodbye.
The Moral Maze was chaired by Michael Burke and produced by David Coombs.